Welcome to Zessions. My name is Mandy Rourke.
My name is Sepna Srivastav.
We are both couple and family therapists, and
we want to do our part to destigmatize mental health and give a glimpse of what the mental health care experience can be.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our session. If you're new here, we are excited for you to be here with us and joining us today. My name is Mandy Rourke, and I am a licensed marriage and family therapist in Austin, Texas, and I am also one of the co-founders of Zesho.
And I am Dr. Sepna Srivastav, and if that's a different sounding title, it's because it is. I finally finished the dissertation and it is official. I can call myself doctor in marriage and family therapy. And I'm also a co-founder of Zesho. We're really excited to welcome you back to Zessions. Zessions are conversations amongst clinicians. We talk about topics that are typically addressed in the mental health world with the perspective of clinicians who support clients daily.
Yes. And today we are really, really happy and excited to be with Dr. Gabby Hurtado. She is a partner of Zesho and also a co-founder of Prickly Pear Therapy and Training, and they offer incredible resources. And we have just been looking forward to having this conversation with Gabby for a while of just, we want to pick your mind because we're talking about a really intense and important topic. And we know that this is one of your areas of expertise. Our topic today is trauma-informed care for suicidal ideations and suicide. So I want to pass the mic over to you, Gabby, so you can introduce yourself and share a little bit more about you and your work.
Well, thank you so much for having me and Sabna. I'm so excited. Congratulations. It's a big deal. So I am one of the co-founders of Prickly Pear Therapy and Training, which is a practice here in Austin, Texas, as you mentioned, Mandy. And my area of expertise as a clinical psychologist is on trauma-informed care and providing assessment and evaluation for neurodiverse folks. And prior to that, I was doing a lot of clinical work around trauma-informed care at the intersection of cultural responsive care, suicidal behaviors, depression, anxiety, and other internalized behaviors. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wonderful. Oh, well, we're so, so glad to have you here today. We know this is an important topic that we definitely wanted to touch on in the pod. And we're really grateful to have you here to discuss it with. And we wanted to make sure that we jumped on the opportunity to discuss it with you. And so as we're getting started with this topic, I also wanted to start sharing a bit of a disclaimer. Like, this topic is very sensitive. It is really intense. It can be distressing and triggering. And so for anyone out there listening or watching, please do prioritize taking care of yourself. If that means stopping the episode, if you feel overwhelmed, or, you know, feel anything coming up for you that's distressing, like, please, by all means, it might mean skipping this episode altogether. Please do what's best for you. And please also know that anything that you hear on this episode are just thoughts and ideas. They're not prescribed care. Definitely kind of refer to care with an actual clinician that you can speak to about your situation specifically. And for reaching more care and support, there is the 988 Crisis and Suicide Helpline for those in the United States. And we'll also provide some more resources in our show notes and towards the end of the episode as well, that you can also utilize and have handy at any point should they be helpful to you. And so we also do want to make sure that you feel that kind of experiencing suicidal ideation and experiencing, you know, attempts at suicide even, it's not something that you're alone in, and that you have people here who care and who can be supportive of you. And that's something that we hope that folks can take away from this episode, among many other things as well. But just wanted to include that.
Thank you. Always good to start off with that just acknowledgement from the start. Because this is, you know, as we were preparing for this conversation, we were also just really being considerate about how do we want to talk about this? Because we know that, you know, and we'll actually talk about that in our session today around how can you talk about this? Because it is a topic that, you know, there's been a lot of stigma attached to it and fear attached to knowing how to talk about it. So let's just start talking about it, I guess, as I'm talking about it. So first, one thing we always like to do in sessions is lay the foundation of getting really clear around definitions. And, you know, in the therapist community, when we say trauma and care, we're kind of like, okay, trauma informed care. But we were thinking that specific to this episode with Gabby, that it'd be helpful to really break down first, what does trauma mean? There's so many different layers and complexities within that. And so we want to start with that, and then we'll kind of branch off as the conversation takes us to figure out, you know, what does it mean to have or receive trauma-informed care? So we'll start with that, Gabby.
For sure. And I think that with that trauma-informed care and just trauma as a word, sometimes that gets thrown around when we're talking about maybe difficult experiences, period, right? Or sometimes kind of this thing that we say about the treatment that we provide. And so I'm glad that we're making space to clarify what that means so people know what to expect. So when we talk about trauma, there's a few different exposures and experiences related to trauma. Usually what we understand and think when we think about trauma is PTSD, and it's this very specific presentation of what trauma is. And that means a response to a traumatic event in which we felt like our safety or that of somebody that we care about was compromised. And we can experience this directly, or we can experience this through learning about the event in detail. And that translates into a specific experience of distress, you know, comprised of re-experiencing through nightmares or flashbacks. We see folks have a negative mood or affect consistently that can look like irritability or depression, and usually it's associated to this event. We also note that folks experience hyperarousal, hypervigilance. So there's this constant altered, you know, experience of agitation, anxiety, preoccupation, constantly worried about our surroundings and safety and ensuring that those are, you know, safe. And so our brain is it takes a lot of space to think about that. And other, you know, other presentations that might be included within that too might be interpersonal in nature, right? We might have a hard time trusting other people. We might have a hard time trusting ourselves and just in general, trusting the world around us. Because usually when a traumatic event happens to us, or we experience that closely, it is going to impact how we see everything within us and around us. So with that, we have, of course, the experience of this acute level of stress that after 6 months, according to DSM, we would consider that PTSD. That can happen for years at a time, right? Or it can happen for a few months. And usually we associate it to one single discrete event that happened. We also know that there's folks that experience multiple traumatic events in their life, and the compounding effect of those traumatic events, we now understand them as a field as complex trauma, meaning that somebody experienced this traumatic event for a long period of time on multiple instances. And then we have what we as clinicians refer to developmental trauma, in which we know that this traumatic event happened at key stages within the development of an individual, usually early childhood, or big developmental transitions, adolescence, young adulthood, just as different milestones, and is going to impact more so our sense of self in relationships. Usually that developmental trauma is linked to safety within a relationship, usually associated with caregivers. So when we think about developmental trauma or complex trauma, we're thinking about experiences like domestic violence or interpersonal violence, sexual or physical abuse, neglect, abandonment, parental alienation, right? Like, we're talking about this more complicated events. The DSM criteria still hasn't got caught up to all these different experiences. And so when we talk about trauma in context of the DSM, that might look a those labels might look a little bit different.
And so I also wanted to clarify, speaking of the DSM, when we say PTSD, that stands for post-traumatic stress disorder, and is kind of a more widely used acronym, which is why we tend to often kind of brush over it too, but want to make sure that people are aware of that. And then kind of within that, you explained all of those beautifully. And I also wanted to ask, how does trauma-informed care tend to look, or what does that involve, or how would you describe that in the context of kind of now understanding a little bit better what the word trauma can encompass?
So to simplify things, trauma-informed care would acknowledge and understand the impact that traumatic events have on an individual and would attend to that. And the way that we would attend to that is that we know that folks that have experienced traumatic events will have difficulty trusting. So we would create an environment that is safe emotionally and physically. So that includes, right, like our physical space. It includes our policies and procedures. It includes giving information to people ahead of time. This environment would highly be focused on avoiding re-traumatization. So we would never want to replicate the conditions in which our clients were traumatized, or even in organizations, right? We would never want to replicate the conditions in which people were traumatized or hurt. And so building collaboration, building trust, giving people agency, respect, are going to be at the core of trauma-informed care. And that includes allowing people to make decisions about their care, having a voice and that voice respected during treatment, right, or in the work that you're doing. So.
I think as you're describing that, that feels like there could be a missing link out there when it comes to trauma-informed care. I mean, I think as you're describing it, you clearly have a background in this, and it's something that is so familiar to you. And I'm kind of jumping ahead in some of our questions here, but it feels appropriate to ask, like, how as a client, a potential client, would you be able to identify, okay, this clinician is someone who is informed in trauma-informed care? You know, they may have some stuff on their website that looks like they're informed, but, you know, like, what would be some of those green flags, if you will, that you would help someone who is seeking therapy, maybe for the first time, to look for?
So it would be somebody that you have an authentic conversation with. So it doesn't feel, of course, you know, I say that with the caveat, the initial sessions, the intake, the consultations when you're meeting us, they're very intrusive, right? Like, you don't know us, we're asking you all kinds of personal questions. And so the process can feel, and it is very intrusive. But I think somebody that provides you information ahead of time, right? So telling you what to expect for the initial session, what the process is going to look like, what their style is. Somebody that asks you a lot of questions about yourself, not only at the symptom level, right? Or like whatever your presenting concern is, but really talking about or focusing on strengths, getting a sense of what your interpersonal style is, notices or comments, right, on what is happening in the session or consultation. So that might mean, you know, suddenly people might start kind of feeling a little bit wiggly, right, in their seat, or impatient, and somebody that is curious about what that experience is like. And I cannot emphasize enough, with someone, that treatment is collaborative. So it's not somebody that is going to dictate what your treatment goals should or should not be is not somebody that is going to dictate what treatment should or should not look like. Somebody that is going to ask you and have humility around questions about sometimes being wrong or missing the mark, is somebody that is going to say, hey, can I offer you some feedback, right? Can I offer a suggestion? This is in my experience, right? When people present with these concerns, this is something I found helpful. This is what the research tells us. How do you feel about that? And having those very open conversations around, what the day-to-day in therapy might look like. And somebody that is willing to talk about uncomfortable topics in a very authentic manner. And that includes things like what we're going to talk about today, right? Suicidality, trauma, people that can provide you education around what your experience might mean. A lot of us go into therapy and we don't, of course, we don't have the language, right? To say, oh, this is what is happening within my body and my experience. A trauma-informed therapist is going to be able to explain, right? And say, and normalize people that have experienced trauma might struggle with XYZ or might have difficulty or might prefer XYZ and be curious about how all those things represent you or show up for you and be able to provide you with that feedback and knowledge or resources as well.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And I particularly appreciate you emphasizing the collaborative nature and kind of giving examples of what that sounds like. I'm wondering like kind of what examples of what it shouldn't be sounds like. I think what comes to mind for me is just like kind of people being, or clinicians rather, being really explanatory and being like, this is what you're experiencing, and like, you know, in a way that they're not checking in with you too and being like, does that fit for you? Or giving you any options of like directions you want to go in for your therapy, that type of thing. 'Cause I think I ask this, because I think oftentimes clients don't realize when the care is maybe not the best fit, especially if it's their first experience. So I wanted to clarify that as well. And then also ask, do you recommend a green flag being clinicians having additional training in trauma-informed care or using specific modalities?
I think that yes, I think it might be helpful, right, for people to have more tools on their tool belt to be able to provide those strategies to clients. And at the same time, I think that one of the things that I saw often in our training, right, is that once I go to this training or once I have these tools, then I know things, right? And then I'm the expert on things. And I can bring those tools back to my clients. And so I think that on one hand, that is really important in the interpersonal work that we have to do to be able to deliver those skills in a way that is helpful is also going to be important. And what I mean by that is understanding our own biases, right? Understanding our own fears, hesitations, how maybe our own trauma or our own experiences show up in the room and the impact that we have on other people, especially on clients. So that interpersonal work is not something that I think most programs will train you in, or even most certificate programs, right? Or more of the additional training that we do that comes through supervision and developing like the identity of the therapist or the therapist of the therapist. And so I think the tools are important and the delivery is going to be as important to that. So that, yeah, the tools can be applied effectively and that folks are going to be open to receiving that, right? And open to also talk about things that are really difficult, especially when you're trying to implement those skills for yourself and you can't, right? Like something isn't working out. Being able to have that space to come in and like troubleshoot what maybe is getting in the way of the implementation of some of those strategies. Yeah, that's my two cents that come through mine.
No, I appreciate it too, because it's very much, I mean, I think, you know, some newer clinicians, or I mean any clinician really, can, you know, can fall into the trap of being like, okay, I have this protocol or I have all this information. And so, you know, or even just this fear that like I have to, or this feeling I have to be the expert here to solve for people's pain. Like this is what I, maybe a lot of helpers went into the profession to do. Like this is my job. But it is very much like a both and. I want to have all this information to be part of who I am as a therapist and my own knowledge that I can share. But at the same time, I really have to understand my client and I have to lean into who they are, what is comfortable for them, what is not comfortable for them, their own expertise and their own inner wisdom, and have more of the focus on that. But it's like, I mean, we're getting into some of the clinician speak here, but it is like, that's the job, right? Of how do you hold both of those things and kind of do that dance. And it makes me think, learning about some of this stuff in grad school, which was like, I don't remember the official term that they said, but it was maybe like pendulation, you know, where it's like, how far do you really go when it comes to talking about your traumatic experiences from a clinician? How, like, what's your pace when it comes to talking with clients about that? But then also, as we're talking about this from the client's perspective too, it's us as clinicians helping our clients decide too, like what feels okay for them to discuss and when are they ready to discuss it? Because I've certainly had clients come that I've worked with before in the past where they're like, this therapist just wanted to go into all of it from the start because I disclosed something in the initial paperwork and I wasn't ready for that. And then next thing you know, that was a distressful experience for me. So I think all that to say that it really feels like the philosophy here is that we're gonna seek to empower the client and their expertise in these sessions and help them lean into that versus like dictate anything that, you know, just we feel is best, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I'm thinking about how I was trained. I was trained in a very behavioral approach for this culture. And so sometimes the ways that we think about how we connect with clients, right, in therapy or at least in my experience, they were spoken in this very strategic or like in very, okay, this is the skill that we're gonna, you know, develop. And so we talked a lot about validation, different levels of validation. What that is really trying to get at is that you want to be authentic about it and strategic, right, with your disclosure. And by strategic, I mean something that is going to be helpful for the client. Mm-hmm. And that you want to make sure that you are validating the experience of the client while also pushing for change. Mm-hmm. And the only way that we can do that is by being authentic. We can use those strategies, but it's going to land when we're able to authentically build connection with our clients. If you had asked me that 10 years ago, I'd be like, no, you know, we can just learn skills and apply them and it's fine. And I think that there might be people that works really well on a very directive, you know, approach, but for highly traumatized folks, where people with complex trauma, that interpersonal relational component is going to be everything. Mm-hmm. If there's no trust, you're not going to be able to deliver those beautiful skills that are going to be super helpful. And so that is going to require that extra work, maybe that extra training, supervision, consultation, or whatever other steps we take as professionals to work on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really, really appreciate you diving into that a little bit more, because I think that is an underrated piece that's usually not relayed enough to clients, especially in considering who to work with. And especially when looking for someone who's trauma informed, because sometimes we tend to hang our hats so much on like the trainings and, you know, the certifications and all of that. And that's really, really important. And I think, in my opinion, should be a very central piece of especially trauma related work.
Right.
And it's not everything.
Right.
And it needs to be coupled with feeling like you can connect with this person authentically, both mm-hmm. on the client's end as well as on the clinician's end, and being able to connect and build even the space for that trust. That trust might take a long time to come, but even having like the opportunity to create that trust together is really, really key. So definitely appreciate you emphasizing that.
And sometimes, you know, we think about those points of connections as a means to an end, right? Like that is the way that I'm going to deliver or like get buy-in, right, for the client to be able to do some of this work. But I think that it can also be a really powerful intervention. For a lot of folks, therapy is a first space where they feel seen and heard and validated. And so, and I'm not saying that all of therapy has to be this beautiful feel-good process. In fact, it's most likely not going to be. So when when I'm talking about trust and relationship, I also talk about having difficult conversations, right? And confrontations in therapy of like what's working and what isn't working, and some of the things that as providers we're seeing, right, that are coming up maybe in the relationship or as barriers to using the different skills or whatever other thing might happen in that bandwidth, right, of what you were talking about, Mandy, of that back and forth of validating, creating that space and pushing for change and pushing for those for that implementation of the intervention. So it should be a little bit of all of it, but the trust and safety at the center.
Well, and I think as we think about trust and safety, I think that's, as you're saying, the key ingredient to open up conversations that are, maybe the first time a client has ever discussed some of this stuff. I mean, I have definitely a client say to me, like, I've never shared this with anyone before. And it's something that like I absolutely honor with like it's a sacred space for me that I treat with a lot of respect, but it is something that I think even with that there can be some nerves around talking about things like what we're talking about today, suicidal ideation or suicidality. And there's so many different layers to this that we tried to kind of break them down into some questions, but maybe we just start by talking about how would you define what suicidal ideation is, and maybe within that, the difference between, different versions within that suicidality as a whole.
Yeah. So suicidal ideation, just very general, right? It relates to the thoughts of or impulses around thinking about hurting oneself or ending someone's life. And this can show up in multiple ways, right? It can be in a passive way. So sometimes for our clients, it can show up as, I wish I was dead. I wish I didn't wake up tomorrow. I'm very tired. I feel stuck. I don't think anything ever is going to change. What is the point of this? But there's no plan to take someone's life. There's no intent to take your life or hurt yourself, right? And then it can move into more of this active suicidal ideation, where we start seeing those thoughts coupled with ideas of how we might carry this on, of moving more into an area of intent, where we see hopelessness really settle in. And of course, there are varying degrees of that, where somebody might have attempted, kind of this various thoughts about how they might hurt themselves. And then it can escalate all the way to having a very detailed plan of how and where and when they would do this. And they have the intention to do it. And again, there's this intense agitation usually and hopelessness that accompanies that. And then we have a suicide attempt, and then we have completed suicide or death by suicide. And one of the things I want to say with that is that for a long time, when we heard people talking about suicide, we said that somebody committed suicide. And so one of the things I want to invite everybody listening is to not use that term and instead moving at death by suicide instead of that committed suicide. Just because it carries that stigma of this very intentional act, almost like sinful or shameful act. And that is not to minimize the consequences of an attempt. But I do think it minimizes the suffering that people are experiencing when we say somebody committed suicide instead of they died by suicide. And so something to think about.
Yeah, super important distinction that so people may not be familiar with. So yeah, thanks for pointing that out. And Yeah, I also wanted to open up a discussion around kind of what often tends to be behind suicidality or suicidal ideations, because definitely from a marriage and family therapy perspective, and also as a bit more of like a narrative therapist myself, I definitely kind of tend towards understanding functionality behind some of the things we experience, and that kind of includes suicidal ideations. And so I was wondering, from your perspective, are there things that you tend to see, notice, or have, seen in the research, or from your clients' perspectives, et cetera, on what can be the purpose behind what it serves? And I may not be explaining this very well.
I know what you mean. What leads or what is the function, right, of some of these? And so some of these thoughts. And so for suicide ideation, I think that it may carry a little bit of different function for folks. And that is that sometimes it can be one an escape, right? Red button, if you will, of, well, I'm experiencing significant distress, significant pain, and this would provide me some relief. And sometimes the relief comes from simply thinking about it as a possibility, all the way to having a plan and carrying it forward. We know that people that at our highest risk of suicide, not only do they have, they're in this active suicidal ideation stage, but also have what we call the acquired capability for suicide. What that means is that as humans, our strongest drive is going to be to survive. And what we see in these individuals is that they tend to take a lot of high risks, and the fear of dying decreases significantly, right? It's something that not only cognitively we might be more comfortable with, but it's also physically. Physically, the idea of taking your life or dying, it's going to trigger a very innate fear response. That fear of response is going to be not as active, or is going to be impacted when that active suicidal ideation has been going on for a while, coupled with psychological and even physical pain, plus experiences of trauma and distress that create desensitization to death. So when somebody has those plus, right, we have components of loss and hopelessness, and this feeling that nothing is ever going to change or matters. We don't really have a reason to live. That's when we're really going to see people at a very high risk, in addition to people access to lethal means. We know that in the United States, most suicides are carried by gunshot wounds, followed by suffocation and then poisoning. So access to weapons, access to items that somebody can use for suffocation, or medication that people can use for, poisoning themselves, or different substances. So when we have somebody that has all of those components, they're going to be at a higher risk for a suicide attempt or a completed suicide. Sometimes we, I think that when, at least for me, when I was learning about this, desensitization that happens. I was very curious about what drove that. And so a lot of the times we think of desensitization as this like simply exposure, right, to maybe these thoughts or maybe sensations of pain. And so usually in my mind that was related to self-harm, maybe cutting, burning, right? Some of the things that we talk to clients about around self-harm. And for a lot of clinicians, I think self-harm is equated to a suicide attempt. And so I think that, Sapna, what you mentioned around intentionality and functionality of those behaviors is going to be really important to explore. as well as the lethality of those behaviors that people are using, right? Somebody may not have the intent to die. It might be using very lethal methods to hurt themselves. And somebody may have the full intention to die and not be using lethal methods. Either way, we need to take those behaviors seriously, right? And trying to understand that full component. I think there's going to be those different levels. And again, bringing it back to the relationship, right, is when we have a client that is experiencing maybe pretty significant hopelessness, we know that they have a lot of stressors. We need to have some hard conversations about what they might be considering, right? Like what their cognitive experience might be, what their physical experience might be, what their intent is, what the reasons for living, might be. Access to weapons and have conversations pretty openly about those things. And of course, there's going to be a difference between, clinicians that work with clients and their client happens to have suicidal ideation or be experiencing suicidal intent and managing that as a crisis versus clients that experience this more chronically, right? And we need to manage and address that in a different way. And that those are resources that we need as clinicians for that.
Yeah, I think that's helpful for you to break it all down for us. And I'm, as you're describing this, I'm thinking about a conversation that I had back in practicum where, I mean, as you just said, like therapists have to get really comfortable talking about this very openly with their clients. Like you were just saying, like having some of those hard conversations. And, as we were preparing for this call or our conversation just before, we were also starting to kind of narrow in on some of the myths that are out there about suicide, because I definitely know that, clinicians that are trained in trauma still, it's like if their client shares something like that, their own fear, their own anxiety may come up and could hesitate, cause hesitation for them to be direct and be open about what was just said. Maybe it's their own fear of competency and being able to solve for whatever that is. And so I think having those direct conversations is going to be key, but it also, I think, is important maybe for us to get into some, what are some of those myths of like, why would a clinician be afraid? Or why would even, I'm kind of bringing this into like family and friends, what would cause the hesitation to talk about it just in general with some of those myths that do surround this topic?
And one of the things that, we were saying is like it's a high stakes conversation,
Yeah.
right? We're talking about somebody's life here. And so it wouldn't make sense to feel nervous, afraid, sad. If it's somebody that we care about, it's going to be really hard to hear that. If it's, of course, one of our clients, of course, we care for our clients. And there's also the difference in that role, right? Where we are going to be there to outline the support that our clients might need and maybe to foresee what are some of the other things that might come up. So I think competency as clinicians is going to be, I think it's at the center of what makes us so uncomfortable to talk about suicide. But also suicide is something that even when you say the word suicide, people just, have this intense reaction to. Because again, the stakes are high. We have a lot of misunderstandings about suicide. It's not something that we understand really well and that we can predict very well. And so it makes everybody a little bit nervous. And as therapists, we're people, so we carry that. And I want to say, a lot of the times, and I would say in most programs, we don't get taught about how to have these conversations. We don't get taught how to do a suicide assessment and how to manage suicidal behaviors. We might, maybe if we're lucky, get some experiences in our practicums around safety points, or what to look for when somebody endorses that intake question, right? Of have you ever thought about killing yourself or dying or hurting yourself? And somebody says yes, then you know what legally steps you need to take. But beyond that, it can feel really intense and not for us to not know what to do. So one of the main myths that we I think carry is that if we talk about suicide, then somebody is more likely to attempt, or that we might implant this thought in their mind. In the reality is that folks that are experiencing intense depression, agitation, hopelessness, it is very likely that they had had these thoughts already. And so actually what it does is to put at the forefront that if you're having those experiences, it's common to also experience suicidal ideation, right? And it's not this this thing that somebody has to carry alone. And we can validate that, right? And so I think it opens actually the door to then have conversations about what might be happening for our clients. Because even though suicide for a lot of people seems like something impulsive and that it just kind of happened at random, most of the times it's not. It's a more complicated process that we might not be privy to, especially if we're the friends or family members, or even as clinicians, but it's not something that just happens suddenly. That there's impulsive behaviors associated with it, there can be. But that doesn't mean that suicide is an attempt, is an impulsive decision all the time. And so by us talking about it, the more that we talk about it, the more that we're likely to remove that stigma, and we can have more meaningful conversations around that. And on the other side of that is that if somebody is talking about suicide, is talking about self-harm, that is always simply about a cry for help or wanting attention, and that maybe we don't need to take it very seriously. Anytime that somebody's talking about taking their lives, hurting themselves, we need to take that seriously. If it happens 25 times, 25 times, we have to take it seriously. As clinicians, that might look a little bit different for us in that we might do some very extensive digging right at the beginning of understanding the mechanics of how that looks like for our clients, the functionality of that, how do clients usually get to that point, common triggers, all of that. And so the conversation looks a little bit different as we are working on this and working on safety. But we always want to take it seriously. And we always want to make sure that we're having conversations around access to mean, intent, plan, those kinds of things. No suicide contract or a promise to not attempt suicide is not a binding agreement, right? Somebody can have a no suicide contract on their file and still attempt or still complete suicide. And in fact, most evidence will tell us that no suicide contracts don't work. Because again, it's not an authentic understanding, right, of what the client is. It's really maybe a tool that had the best intentions behind it, but it sounds like very much self-serving for the clinician rather than of service to the client. Sometimes, you know, people might promise to a friend, no, I'm not going to do anything about this. I'm going to be okay. And they still have access to me, and they still have the intent, and they still have all these experiences together. And so we might need to enlist additional help for that. Those are the ones that I think are very frequent, aside from, well, another one would be once somebody has, or like is set on taking their lives, there's no way to stop them. And what we do know is that actually those moments of crisis can be short-lived. And so we want to make sure that we're adding a lot of different skills and resources to really encourage someone to stay alive, to stay safe, and really curb that intent to die by suicide. And of course, this is when we would enlist some of those additional crisis management tools that as therapists we have. Yeah, I think those are the ones that I think come up very frequently. Of course, there's a ton more, and I'm happy to share some resources of myths and facts and statistics around this. So, you know, we can explore them and get a little bit more comfortable when we're having these conversations.
Yeah, those are so important to have touched on, though. So thank you for bringing those up. And especially while you were talking about kind of the contract to not harm and it being ineffective, like just also remembering like that can just make it less safe for clients to actually bring up what they're experiencing as far as suicidal ideations go. It can cut off that additional form of support. And I'm also curious, you know, knowing that that's not effective, what are things that are effective that it would be helpful for clinicians to be doing? It's been shown to be effective or more effective than that opposite of like contract to not harm or those types of interventions.
So definitely suicide safety planning is going to be really helpful, right? And the reason for that, and especially this very collaborative and very open, is that you're going to have an understanding of the client's experience when they are feeling suicidal, right? The level of stress, anxiety, pain that they're experiencing. What might be some of those trigger points for them that when that is happening, they can pay attention in how it shows up for them. And then having a sense of the safe people in their lives, both to have conversations that can distract them or provide some relief, but they don't necessarily have to talk about everything that is going on. And then who the safe people in their lives are to talk about what is hard and truly what is happening, outlining, you know, the resources and the steps that a client can take in detail. And having conversations around, you know, access to means, what they have available at home, and having a plan of who they can give that to, who can help them monitor, who can be supportive in that process. And then outlining too, and having conversations of, especially around hospitalization, right? Like, what is it that that would look like? What would it look like if, you know, the danger is imminent? What steps would they take for achieving safety when you would contact their emergency contact? You know, involving really this family and friends that the client may have available. Really working around reasons for living and reasons for dying. So you understand what might be some of the stressors that are happening for the client. And there's a lot of tools out there. There's one that is called the CAMS, and I'm happy to link some resources around that. I forget what the full acronym is, but I think it's Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicide or Suicidality. And the reason why I really like that one is because it's, as it says, it's very collaborative. So it's actually encouraged to have very open conversations with clients about different areas of risk, hopelessness, stress, recent changes, recent losses, to get a snapshot of where the client is. Of course, if appropriate, developing a safety plan and linking the client to resources. And then it outlines other interventions of what might be helpful. And so it can be complementary therapy, you know, intervention to what you're already doing. And it can be aligned to some of the things that we're already trained in, but it talks about how to implement them in this context. And so I think that can be really powerful. Of course, in other systems, like especially for folks that might be at high risk, like veterans within the VA, there's a lot of different resources and checkpoints that people can go through to provide support. But I think for private practices, small agencies, right, outpatient therapy, that can be a really, or even primary care, I think that that is something that you can implement pretty quickly. And of course, we know that dialectical behavioral therapy or DBT is usually very helpful for folks that are in crisis, especially the distress tolerance module and the crisis specific skills. And so having some of those in hand can be really helpful, especially when the client is in, you know, this really intense level of distress, for having something tangible to go and to do and implement immediately. Also, as part of DBT, there's this Linehan rating form, or the L-RAMP, that I'm also happy to, you know, put as a resource. where it walks you through the different risk factors for clients, the different protective factors for clients. Sometimes we focus a lot on risk factors. We also want to know what is going well and what are the resources that our clients are so that we can enhance them and capitalize on them. And one of the things that I find beautiful about that measure is that it has a decision process for. So you think through, the level of risk that the client is. If you decide for hospitalization, if you decide against hospitalization, and then what supports or plans, check-ins you'll have with the client. I said that I really like that because I think for clinicians or for anybody, right, we're talking about a very difficult, emotionally charged, stressful topic. And I think, at least in my experience, I've never felt really calm while having these conversations. And there's always, right, like even after the session, you're thinking about, did I make the right call? Right? I'm trusting that I have the relationship with this client, that they went home and I know that I have solid rationale for it. And still, right? Like I might still be carrying a little bit of anxiety. And so sitting with that allows you kind of solidify your thought process or consider it something that you hadn't. And so it walks you through all those steps. And it can be just a also a good way of documenting your session and intervention with clients. But yeah, those are the ones that I like. Now for family and friends, that of course is going to look different. You might not do like a full safety plan with people. But I think that you can also talk about, what is helpful. What are you doing for this? Do you have a therapist? Do you have access to something, right? When things are hard, do you need help finding a therapist or support? What can you do in the moment that is helpful? Can I help you, right? Like find some of these things. Can you talk to me when things are hard? And so I think in that moment, when somebody discloses that suicidality, it's really about sitting with someone in their pain without trying to fix it. And maybe helping a client stay or a family member and a friend stay safe for that moment. And that might be being that bridge between services, right? Or support, that conversation and support. Because as a friend and a family, we cannot effectively also treat and manage suicidality. That is something that needs to happen in a different space. And so we can be a resource, and there might be limitations for that, even for those of us that are therapists. And there's a lot of different resources out there. So we can be that bridge and help with that. Or sometimes, right, driving somebody to the hospital, making sure they get assessed. And supporting them through that process if that's necessary. Sometimes I'm going along with the meds, right? Sometimes people say, well, I won't say anything about it. I'll just keep it a secret. And that's never helpful. Unless, of course, there's like a lot of context there, but to oversimplify, right? It's not helpful to keep those secrets if that is going to cost somebody their safety. So instead, we want to make sure that we are connecting ourselves and our loved one with the resources that they might need. And sometimes that means, right, calling the Lifeline or calling other organizations that have advocates that have other kinds of resources and that can really help you and your loved one get the help they need.
I appreciate all of those resources so much, and I just wrote down, it is really, from a clinician perspective and also from a friend or family member, coworker, whoever it may be, the focus in the situation really is around safety and offering supportive resources, but not having this mentality of like, I have to solve. It's like, I really just have to sit with, and we use the terminology of like, share space or hold space, and it's really just allowing that space for the person who is experiencing this, because I definitely know through many conversations over the years that different cultural identities and backgrounds, you know, that this could have been something that they've had fleeting thoughts or not so fleeting thoughts of for a lot of their life, and a lot of messaging, whether that be religious or, you know, for whatever reason, it could have been impressed. Like, we don't talk about this. We will never utter those words. If you utter those words, it means this. I mean, there's just so many different layers to that, that I can just, you know, anticipate the profound impact of someone finally, you know, gaining the courage to say something, and that to be met with, like, I'm here with you, versus don't feel that, or, you know, the toxic positivity, or like, things will get better, you know. And as much as I love this too shall pass, it's, again, it's like that need to solve versus just be with. And so I really appreciate you attending to that. And also, you know, the different resources that I know many clinicians can access. I know I definitely have some savvy clients that are like, can I access these too? And it seems like it's something that they could explore, just to, you know, that's one of our biggest goals here, is to help kind of break down this hierarchy of, you know, this is just clinician only stuff. It's like, you know, be able to access some of these tools that clinicians look at too, to, for me, it goes back to Sepna a little bit of this is externalizing the problem from yourself a little bit, and being able to kind of witness like what's going on here versus this is an inherent part of who I am. It's an experience that you're having. And I think on that note, it kind of goes into what I'm talking about or what I'm sharing in response, but it's like, how do you have a conversation along, you know, as a clinician of, I want to validate your pain, and I also want to try to be a clinician that holds hope and shares some of that in these sessions? Because I would imagine it is doing that dance too with your clients.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things to have in mind, right, is that some of our clients will have conversations about, you know, what it means for them to be alive, what are the reasons for living, and they'll be able to like come up with something. There will be moments where we ask about reasons for living and there's nothing. Sometimes for many reasons, people can find themselves in this space, right? So where things are really hard and they're stuck, sometimes literally and sometimes cognitively, right? It's not that they're creating a barrier for themselves. It's just the place that they are in life. And so I think that we have to be, I think, Maria, really like that you said, right? We have to decenter ourselves. And this also goes for family members, right? This is not about how the pain that somebody else is having makes us feel. That is unhelpful in that moment, because it's not really about us. It's really about what the person is experiencing in this really intense pain and suffering that they're experiencing. And so I think that first and foremost, we need to make space, hold space for that, right? And recognizing that the person in front of us is talking about something that is really wrong and intense, and they're talking to us about it, right? If they didn't want help, if they didn't care about their relationship, whatever, they could just leave our office or leave our homes and hurt themselves. But instead, they're having a really hard conversation and a really vulnerable conversation. And so I think that sitting with that and allowing a person to label their experience fully is going to be really important. So we decenter ourselves, we create that space, right? And then we follow that with, you know, different resources that we can and that we have available depending on our role in the conversation. But in creating that space, I think validating that the emotion makes sense, right? That it would make sense that if you're feeling depressed and you've experienced sometimes the worst things that people can experience, that it would make sense to feel hopeless and stuck. And think about what would be helpful, right? And sometimes taking that pain away can feel good. One thing that I didn't talk about in when we talk about risk is also our sense to, so also people that are experiencing suicidal ideation are going to be people that are also experiencing this sense of being a burden to other people and feel disconnected from others, right? And I don't mean that in a literal sense in that, oh yeah, I'm not talking to anybody, but like that as a human, you don't have a space to be. And so part of the work that we can do and where the hope is I think to validate that experience in one hand and to recognize that even if we don't have that at this moment, that there is a way through. And maybe the way through is going to be painful and raw, and maybe the worst thing that we've gone through, and there's still another side, and holding that for our clients. So when we go back to the beginning of the conversation, we're talking about like trainings and all these things, right? I think that the training on this can allow us to conceptualize our client and conceptualize hope of what we can see at the end of that tunnel, right? Because we've seen it, because we're trained in this, because we have different skills, because we know their research. And so we know that there is another side and we can hold on to that. And the relationship is really what's going to allow for our clients to trust that even if they're going through the worst pain, we're asking them to do things that are extremely painful and difficult as a client, right? That they trust us enough to do it anyway. And to talk about like, hey, I cannot do this, right? I'm about to give up hope. And we can have a conversation about it. And sometimes that might be week to week, right? Well, I will show up, right? For some of our clients, the only meaningful connection that they might have is the therapeutic relationship. And so creating that space of validation is really going to be the intervention that we have so that we can bolster that hope, right? And hold that space to for our clients to be able to make it to the other side. But I think in order to ask them to do that, you got to be real, right? And so saying things like, it's going to be okay. We all have a reason to live, right? We all can find those things. Well, sometimes you can't. And that's real. So we're not going to fix that. And we're not going to fixate on that either. But it's also posing the question of like, what would you want your life to look like? What are the kinds of things that you want to create? And why is it possible? And if it's not possible, why? Because of course, we want to be realistic, right, as to what can happen and can't. But sometimes I think folks, especially when they've been suicidal for a long time or they've experienced in, you know, traumatic circumstances, that goes away. In addition to like us not trusting the world and ourselves and other people, that hope to dream about our future, a lot of the times it's going to go away. And for a lot of folks that are traumatized, they think, right, that their life is short and they're gonna have a hard time believing that there's like a tomorrow and a future and what that looks like. And so part of the therapeutic work is going to be to create space for maybe asking those questions. Because maybe our clients have been in survival for so long, that was never a question they asked themselves. With my clients, that's something that came up all the time, right? It was when I asked them like, well, what do you want to do? What do you see in the future? And I'm not talking about 5 years from now. I'm talking in the next year, in the next 6 months. And they're like, nobody has ever asked me that. I don't think I've ever sat down and thought about it because I'm just trying to stay alive today. And so sometimes you change the question, right? Like at the end of the day, what do you want to see? What do you want to feel? What do you want to think about? And then this is when the interventions, right, and all the skills that we know can be really helpful. But I think that, yes, having those conversations and holding the hope for our clients, it's going to be an authentic hope, right? It's going to be really, really important. It's to visualize our clients out of the circumstance. What would their life look like? What would they have in their life that would make it worth living? I think that that's also a hard part of being a therapist. That sometimes it can be, it's not, again, it's not something that we're taught, right? But it's to hope without fixing it on that or trying to fix it and conveying that to our clients all the time with this toxic positivity, but being realistic about it and holding that space.
Yeah, that's really helpful to hear. I love that question being asked. That's so true. That's such like a poignant way of helping to foster a sense of hope and kind of clearing some of the fog of like what could be for the future, and maybe even kind of redirecting the maybe lack of control that they're feeling towards what steps can I take towards creating that future, rather than just trying to manage this pain and suffering that I'm feeling right now. And it can be both and in that way of redirecting it towards the future. So I love you sharing that. Thank you. And I know we're kind of coming up on our time here, but I did want to make sure one more thing that we touch on is like, what can ongoing support look like for individuals who are struggling with and or have a history of suicidal ideation or suicidality? And this can include like, what can ongoing therapeutic work look like, support system look like, protective factors, like what comes up for you in considering that with clients?
So I first think about working with clients and creating safety, right? So what that means is we want to make sure that people are alive, and that the sense of the intent and the planning around hurting oneself decreases. So at the very beginning, when we're talking about suicidality, I spend a lot of time, sometimes like entire sessions, like maybe one or two, understanding the narrative piece, right, around their suicidal behaviors in general. And one of the things that I like from DBT is the chain analysis, and there's different ways to do it, but it's this narrative component and also behavioral, in that we're trying to understand what happened before, you know, this behavior happened. So we understand what led to it. How did it show up? How did it escalate to eventually landing us here? What did this space look like, right? When we're thinking about impulsive behavior, self-harm, suicidal thoughts, plan, intent, or even an attempted suicide event. And so really getting a very clear understanding from me, from the client, with the intention to get a snapshot, right, of like, okay, let's identify these triggers. Let's identify how that shows up for you cognitively, physically, so that then we figure out like crisis strategies and what might be really helpful. So for example, for some of my clients, we work a lot on the TIP skill. So it is this temperature, intense physical activity, and pace breathing, grounding, to be able to create space between the moment that they're feeling distress and the impulsive behavior that follows. Then talking about preventing, right? So if we know that we're about to go through one of those situations that might be a trigger, like, you know, connection with family. So like the holidays might be a big trigger, or a big family event, or just simply a gathering. And we know that that's going to trigger a fight or flight. What is it that we can do? What boundaries do we need? What permissions do we need to give ourselves to create space between us and that emotion? Especially in circumstances where you cannot change them, right? Like they are what they are. Or at work, or in just different scenarios. And then if we get to that point, what skills can we implement? And if we cannot implement those skills, like what might get in the way, right? So really having conversations around all of that. And for my clients, they could call me if they were at the stage where they felt really stuck. But again, I work with most clients that this is part of their clinical picture, this chronic suicidality or self-harm. And so we, you know, I offered some coaching on the phone. If they were trying to implement the different skills or interventions or plans that we had outlined and they weren't working, and they were really focused on skills-based, right? Like what is helpful right now? We're not going to process anything. And that's what the full-time session is for. But in that moment, what is working, what isn't working, and trying to address that so that they can practice it in real time, And sometimes I will practice it and then call me and say, okay, got it. Or this is what it wasn't working. And sometimes we have to have those calls a couple of times. And then having, I think an understanding of those trigger points and what, in working on our clients envisioning what a life of living looks like. So what is it that you want to see in your life? What would that look like? What do you need to get there? It's important. And so really having conversations around values, having conversations around what is important to them, how they are connecting with those things now, or maybe not, how can we start connecting with those values a little bit more frequently? And then what is getting on their way, in their way, right? To implement some of those things or to start connecting with those things. Those are the main like general interventions. Of course, for clients that, I'm an intake, they endorse those set of behaviors, I definitely want to do a full safety plan. Even if they already have one in place from a different therapist or they step down from higher levels of care, I want to review that. And, we talk about what they had and then what has changed and then having that new one. And they have a copy available to them. They usually fill that out. And then I give them resources like crisis text, the lifeline. I know for those of us that live here in Austin, integral care has a line, right? And then we have a conversation about potential for hospitalization. A lot of the clients that I work with have either been in high levels of care or they've, heard about hospitalization. And so we talk about when would we make that call? What would that look like? So we're all like pretty comfortable, right, that the goal is to prevent that. And so yeah, part of the work is kind of to outline all that process and be on the same page while we're working on all these other aspects of safety and identity work and values and value congruent behavior.
Yeah, I'm just so grateful for clinicians like you and so appreciative of conversations like these too, because it really illuminates how, I mean, we've said this in many different ways today, but just the importance of this relationship that you cultivate with your clients and the way that you talk about it here. Like, I can sense the safety and I can sense that trust that, there's that concept of if it's happening in the here and now with their therapist, then it's something that can then be transferred outside of that space too. It just helps them, like fill up their own, feelings of confidence and security and trust within themselves too, to navigate this on their own. And so, I know you've referenced so many different resources today. I mean, there's so many notes I took right now that I'm like, we are going to have to add a lot to the show notes. But before we close out, are there any kind of final thoughts that you want to share with everyone who's listening?
I think that there is another side, right? And that it might be the most challenging, painful thing they've ever done if you're a survivor. Or if you're a clinician, to note that that place exists for your clients. Or if you're a survivor yourself, right, and are doing this work, that there is this other side where you can have a life that is fulfilling and I truly believe that we can help our clients get to that place if they're willing and if we have that connection and that relationship and trust.
Agreed. And thank you for summing that up and for continuing to emphasize that throughout this entire conversation. That's so key and so important. And we do really want to leave listeners with that as an emphasis for sure, of like, you're not alone and there is definitely hope. And we encourage and support finding the support to get through those moments, both kind of in your personal life as well as through a professional and any other means, because you deserve that support 100%. And so we'll get those resources from you. We'll include those in the show notes. We also wanted to ask, in closing, are there what ways can people find you and Prickly Pear and even your podcast?
For sure. So you can find us on our website, PricklyPearTherapy.com. We're also on Instagram as Prickly Therapy, and on Facebook as Prickly Therapy. So you can find us through there. And we have a podcast called The Prickly Couch, which right now we're getting ready to record our third season. So we're very excited. And so in there, you'll hear us have more conversations about what it means to be Latina women and the different identities and experiences that encompasses, if you want to give it a listen.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Gabby. We appreciate your time so much today. And I know that there's just so much invaluable resources and expertise that you've been sharing today. So thank you. We look forward to our next conversation with you.
Yes. Thank you for having me, y'all.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Gabby.